You're listening to Vatican Radio. I'm Phil Andrews. Dr. Serenith James is an honorary research fellow of St. Stephen's House, Oxford, where he also teaches ecclesiastical history. He's also a member of the Faculty of Theology of Oxford University. His doctoral research analysed the part played by Archbishop George Errington in the development of the 19th century Roman Catholic Church in England, and he remains an active member of the Catholic Record Society. He is a contributor to the Oxford Style Guide, a columnist for the Church Times, and a member of the Church of England Cricket Committee. He recently gave the annual Wiseman Society lecture at the Venerable English College here in Rome on the theme A Missing Portrait, Nicholas Wiseman, George Errington, and the Venerable English College. Serenith, thank you for talking to Vatican Radio today.
Not at all, Phil. Great pleasure to be with you.
You must be something of a feature of the academic scene here in Rome, researching, lecturing, and the like.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. I'm in Rome a lot, certainly, partly for work, very often for pleasure, but I always find one can't get to Rome enough these days.
You yourself admit that the title of your recent lecture appears to be quite whimsical. What gave you the idea for such a theme, and who exactly was George Errington?
Well, now, George Errington was a very interesting chap who was appointed to be coadjutor with right of succession to Nicholas Wiseman at Westminster in 1855, with the plan that he would succeed him as Archbishop of Westminster in the fullness of time, Wiseman's health, of course, being constantly fluctuating throughout the 1850s. And the idea was really that had he actually succeeded to Westminster, he didn't, for various reasons. Had he succeeded to Westminster, of course, there would have been a portrait of him at the English College, but there isn't. And I've always thought that is something of an anomaly, because he was hugely involved at the English College, both as a student there and then later as vice-rector. And so one would think that there would be a portrait of this incredibly distinguished alumnus, but there isn't, because it's something of a case of history being written by the winners. And poor old Errington has lost out by being almost constantly on the wrong side of the interpretation of the history of the last 50, 60, 70 years.
It's a commonly held view that Errington, the Englishman with recusant and Jacobite ancestry, appears to have promoted the pro-English and recusant tradition as opposed to the Spanish-born Wiseman's pro-Roman outlook. However, in your book, you argue this is far too facile an argument. What is it that leads you to make this case?
Well, you're quite right to say that people have sort of constantly thought that Errington was somehow sort of opposed to Wiseman's pro-Roman outlook. But in the course of my research, it's become quite clear that they really were very much cast in exactly the same mould. Errington was just as pro-Roman as Wiseman. They were formed in the same way in Rome in the heady days of the resurgence of theology, and particularly in the days of the recently reopened English College. The idea that they were substantially different is, I think, a real red herring, and it's only really a later interpretation by historians, in my view, an inaccurate interpretation, that throws this sort of anti-Roman, pro-Gallican model towards Errington. I think it's perfectly fair to say that by the terms of Ultramontanism in the middle of the 19th century, both Wiseman and Errington were absolute model Ultramontanes. And it was only really later in the century that the view of Ultramontanism began to shift in favour of people like Henry Edward Manning. But I think very much that Wiseman and Errington were totally in the same mould. And the fact that history has separated them and put them on two sides of a coin, that kind of sort of resurgent English Catholicism, is not terribly helpful.
Their time together in Ushaw Seminary and in Rome really cemented quite a link between them, but it appears to me to have been rather one-sided in favour of Wiseman. Am I right in thinking this, especially as Errington appears to have been so well regarded as a scholar here in Rome, even more so than Wiseman, perhaps? Or did they both enjoy equal prestige?
Well, I think certainly at Ushaw they were both distinguished. Errington was a couple of years below Wiseman there, and they certainly knew each other. They were great friends at the English College, where they were contemporaries. The reports that we read from the college at the time are quite clear that Errington was just as much of a scholar as Wiseman, and that his own doctoral defence was hailed in exactly the same way that Wiseman's had been, that they were both the two of the most brilliant young men in Rome. I think part of the problem was that Errington was very much the model of a bluff Yorkshireman, whereas Wiseman was very suave, sophisticated, and always able to sort of see the elegant picture, whereas Errington was very much, I think, head down and getting on with the more intricate details of things. But I think it's perfectly fair to say that Errington was just as much a scholar in Rome as Wiseman. And it's interesting that later history, again, has sort of airbrushed out that part of his character. And certainly in the 1820s, he and Wiseman were both regarded as two of the brightest young things in Rome, with great futures of service for the church ahead of them.
So Wiseman became rector of the English College, but Rector Gradwell, the first rector following the restoration of the college after the French sacking, had been able to temper the negative aspects of Wiseman's appointment by arranging for Errington to become his vice-rector. How did this actually work in practice?
Well, I mean, in many ways, it was a perfect fit because Wiseman, as I said, was able to see the big picture constantly. He had great visions. But I think it was Cardinal Barnabo who remarked to him that he was always with his head in the clouds. He had these great visions for how things could happen and things could change, and he was very good at having great visions, and many of them were very successful. But he had no mind for intricate details of any sort of plan. Now Errington, of course, being brilliant and being very, very bright, and with an administrative mind, was able basically to take on all the administrative duties of the college, and help put Wiseman's plans into action. Which was something he actually did later as well at Oscott College near Birmingham, where he was Wiseman's right-hand man. And that, of course, is partly why Wiseman asks for him to go to be his coadjutor at Westminster, that he is constantly able to supply the shortcomings of Wiseman's administrative life. And so they really were a perfect fit for running an institution like the English College together. And certainly it's Wiseman Errington, who puts the English College financial situation back on a sound footing, as you say, after the sacking of the college. And we find him buying farms, managing them, buying vineyards, selling property, investing in property, that really, I think to some extent, has put the English College on the sound footing it enjoys today. And that's very much... Wiseman could not have managed that on his own, certainly.
Back in England, with episcopal preferment looming, was there a disintegration in relationships between Errington and Wiseman? And how did Cardinal Manning fit into all this, or indeed before he became Cardinal Manning?
Well, now, that, of course, is the big question, because as everyone knows, it was Manning who succeeded Wiseman and not Errington. I think a number of people have been keen to suggest that Manning displaced Errington from the succession to Westminster for the best possible motives, for the good of the church and that sort of sentiment. I don't think that was the case at all. I think Manning was taken into Wiseman's confidence. Wiseman very much, I think, when he finally fell out with Errington, and they fell out over, I think, Dawson's administration, basically, that Wiseman had very little sense of what was canonically proper, whereas Wiseman was an expert canon lawyer. And Errington constantly found himself being overruled in Westminster by the cardinal, who would just make sweeping statements without really any way of backing them up. It was a very frustrating time for Errington. And he found himself in a position of having to contradict Wiseman frequently, which increased the tension between them. And so Wiseman, we find, almost from 1856, really, turning to Manning. Manning being another bright young thing, very, very able man, a very distinguished Anglican clergyman, of course, before his conversion. And we find Wiseman turning to Manning for help more and more. And then effectively, when it comes, and when the balloon goes up, and Wiseman petitions Rome to have Errington removed as his coadjutor in 1860, it's Manning who helps Wiseman prepare his case. Now, I don't think really Manning helped Wiseman prepare his case out of antipathy towards Errington. I think he and Errington disagreed on a number of things, but I think Manning's behaviour towards Errington and Errington's behaviour towards Manning was basically honourable, and Manning acted against him because he was helping and serving Wiseman. I think it's a very simple thing to say that Manning displaced Errington from the coadjutorship, because, of course, that did happen. But it was very much the decision of Pius IX to to make Manning Archbishop of Westminster. He was something of a surprise choice. And although there was lobbying going on in Rome, no one really thought that Manning would be Archbishop of Westminster, least of all Manning himself, at least not until the very last moment. And so we see Errington disappearing from the 1850s, and after 1860 almost disappearing entirely from the history of the Catholic Church in England, and Manning is ascendant. And of course, it's Manning's history that has written all the others. And one after another, they've dealt less and less with Errington. And so I think there is an element of Manning displacing Errington. But I think for a proper view of it, you have to go right back to the sources and to read the contemporary materials. And that's what I've tried to do in my own book.
Also in your book, you introduce us to the Rome-based player Monsignor George Talbot. He seems to have held all the power. So what was his background and how did he come to be so powerful? Indeed, could we say that he was instrumental in destroying the friendship between Errington and Wiseman?
Oh, I think that's perfectly a perfectly fair thing to say. Talbot was a remarkable man. He was, of English aristocratic stock, Anglo-Irish aristocratic stock. He Eton, Christchurch. He had all the marks of a man set out for preferment through family patronage in the Church of England before his own conversion. And then, of course, he goes to Rome, where he becomes great friends with Pius IX. Who almost adopts him as a court favourite. And Talbot becomes, in many ways, Pius's advisor, chief advisor on English affairs. The problem there is, of course, that Talbot didn't really know very much about English affairs. And he functioned as a sort of an unofficial advisor to the Pope, which was very frustrating, I think, not just for Errington, but for almost all the bishops. Because sometimes he would just interpret English affairs in the way he thought they should be interpreted, not necessarily in the way that the bishops in England thought the situation should be presented at Rome. I think, to be fair to Talbot, again, he was not a mentally stable man. He delighted, I think, in power games, and ultimately they destroyed him, and he suffered an immense breakdown and had to leave Rome permanently. Not long before the First Vatican Council. But I think that is an example of how, even in the third part of the 19th century, the Roman court can still function as effectively a medieval, a system of medieval patronage, where people with no real skills or talent could achieve high office simply by enjoying the favour of the reigning pope. Talbot was undoubtedly promoted beyond his capabilities and caused a huge amount of trouble. Not just for Errington and Wiseman. He is a very intriguing character, and I must say, if I had the chance to write another book on the Roman history of the time, Talbot would certainly be my subject, given half the chance.
So how do you think the events of this time have moulded the modern Catholic Church in England and Wales?
Well, I think that is probably an ongoing, changing issue. I think certainly at the time, Errington's removal ensured that the brand of sort of what I've called neo-ultramontanism, the type of ultramontanism embraced by people like Manning and W.G. Ward and Talbot himself, triumphed in the Church in England. I think that had Errington been Archbishop of Westminster, he would have been a very great Archbishop of Westminster, just as Manning was a very great Archbishop of Westminster. I think Newman would have had an easier time with Errington at Westminster. They were great friends. They were very close indeed. In fact, Errington advised Newman on some of his later work, and Newman very much thought of Errington as a mentor and a close friend. So I think that Newman's various disappointments and frustrations might have been alleviated had Errington become Archbishop of Westminster in 1865. And who knows how that would have affected later generations, because it would, of course, have knocked everything on, because with Errington at Westminster, Manning would not have become Archbishop of Westminster, probably would not have succeeded Errington when Errington died in 1886. And then, of course, Cardinal Vaughan would probably not have been Archbishop of Westminster, given the way things, the dates and times. And so it's a very interesting question. You know, where does that sort of leave the history of the church in England? It's a huge what if. And of course, I don't have a crystal ball to be able to tell you exactly what would have happened. But it certainly is, I think, the greatest what if of modern English Catholic history. What if Errington had gone to Westminster? And who would have succeeded him at Westminster? And what direction would his leadership of the Catholic Church in England, Wales, have taken? It's a real poser. I think there's a lot that could be written and said on it. And I hope that my little offering will be helpful to people trying to understand what might have been.
Dr. Serenith James, thank you for talking to Vatican Radio. For Vatican Radio, I'm Phil Andrews. Laudato Jesus Christus.